Hey, it's Norm McIver, and you're listening to Tim and Graham on the 610 Podcast.
Hey, listeners, welcome back to the 610 Podcast. Graham and Tim back in the studios again. What's up?
Not too much. Great day in Ottawa.
Yeah, the weather's fantastic.
Yeah, trying to grow some vegetables in my garden.
Are you kidding or are you being serious?
Very serious. Growing a little victory garden in case the war comes, like I'm expecting.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're probably one of those guys who bakes his own bread too, I bet.
Absolutely. I've got a bomb shelter in my backyard too. Girlfriend's not too pleased with that one, but she'll thank me one day.
So, how are you enjoying the playoffs? It's been another week since we've recorded, so what are you thinking?
Yeah, I'm kind of rough right now. I stayed up late watching that Canucks-Nashville game. It was just like watching a train wreck. That overtime was brutal, so anticlimactic compared to the last Canucks overtime.
I wasn't reading Twitter last night, but there were a bunch of feeds that we followed that said a lot of Canucks fans were leaving during the second overtime. That's irresponsible.
Oh, absolutely. Even when I was a little kid, my dad would never, ever let me turn off the TV during overtime. Even if it was a school night, the rule was you stay up until someone scores in overtime, and that's it, right? You never know what you're going to miss.
There's been so much heartbreak in Vancouver. Maybe they just knew it was inevitable.
Little actions like that that make me a little bit less sympathetic.
That's karma,
to
though.
Them.
That is karma, though.
Yeah, absolutely. And it wasn't going to be the Sedins who scored. It was great. I was really hoping Shane O'Brien would net that one. The media the next day.
A little kick in the nuts.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Perfect.
That would be rich.
Yep. So I've thoroughly enjoyed it so far. Haven't watched any of the Red Wings, but our playoff pool is going fantastic. Our rinkatology pool. I happened to pick both the teams this year because Graham was away on vacation when the rosters were due. So I threw together one for him and one for myself. And currently right now I'm sitting in, 294th place, tied with a bunch of idiot scrubs like myself. And meanwhile, the team I picked for Graham is in first place this morning.
Oh, are we?
Yeah, we are. We are.
That's unreal.
Big cash prizes, too. Never thought I'd be so happy about Luongo and Danny Briere my entire life, as long as some one-round contributions of some overly productive defensemen in the West.
That is fantastic.
So there we have it.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So what do we get if we win?
A lot of money.
Do we?
Yeah, I think it's the cash prizes I know for the whole league is like $3,000 or something.
Really?
Through Rinkatology, yeah. And wow. I think we get $300 for winning plus $700 for finishing first overall. Out of the three leagues, and currently we are first out of all three leagues, so
wow,
it's a lot of beer and chicken wings for us.
Aside from the hockey playoffs, Jason Spezza is obviously over in Slovakia, having his go at the World Championships, playing alongside Ken Hitchcock. We've had a couple nervous tweets from fans.
People just have death wishes in the city.
They just want to keep that guy as far away as possible from the Senators organization. And I just every time I think of Ken Hitchcock, it reminds me of that one quote, I believe it was from a Garriock article, where he said, Jason Spezza could be the next Steve Yzerman under my tutelage. What a dick.
Was Hitchcock looking for a job at this point? I mean,
probably.
I mean, have a look at my resume and see some of the BS that's on there. Surely Hitchcock's no different, right? Trying to sell himself a little high.
Yeah.
In times of need. Of course, yeah. I'll tell you, I could turn Alexi Yashin into Bobby Orr, too. Doesn't make it fact. That's great. That's wonderful. That's what coaches are supposed to do, right? To invoke confidence and to take their players to the next level. Congratulations on thinking you can do your job. That's amazing. Again, that's just done nothing but ill will by leading the Senators fan base to believe that Jason Spezza is a carbon copy of Steve Yzerman and could never be anything but himself.
Yeah, it's like the 2012 All-Star game. It's just a carrot that you dangle in front of the fans, and then hopefully you get that little movement and push towards, oh yeah, this guy would be a fantastic hire for our organization. And the guy has a shelf life of maybe two seasons?
Oh, yeah, max in Ottawa. We know what this place does, but I don't know, maybe considering the past coaching history in Ottawa, he might have a little bit longer leash. And he is a vet coach, something that the past three coaches have not been. Veteran as in professional coach. Although, you know, I'm getting to the point now where I'd kind of like to see someone who's been in the show themselves, someone who's been there and gone through the rigors and understands what it takes to handle a locker room as well as handle the people on the ice. I mean, and, you know, as Ottawa fans, we've seen a lot of problems in the locker room over the years with characters and divides, even the recent rumored stuff about Clouston and his mistreatment of the veterans this year on the ice. God knows if any of it's true or not, but still be nice to have someone who has been through this themselves, who know what the guys are saying amongst themselves, even though they're not privy to that conversation. They still know. Like, you know, you're going to figure out the types pretty quickly. You know, everyone's an individual, but there's still a lot of room to really get a handle on them. And, you know, that's why it would have been nice to see someone like Kirk Muller come in, even Dineen, right? I mean, who knows?
Well, Cunningworth was rumored.
He's kind of fallen out of fashion,
mind you,
though.
Mind you, like, Panzeri, Alan Panzeri from the Ottawa Citizen, made that huge list of coaches. He threw like a one-sentence critique beside each. It was interesting, but at the same time, just like half the list, you're just shaking your head like, why?
Yeah, by the end of
why
it,
why would you do that?
It's kind of like, oh, Brian Murray hired this guy as the you know, assistant coach in Cincinnati when he was with the Ducks and, you know, geez, 2 decades ago.
These two guys once had a barbecue in Shawville and got plastered. And maybe he can be the guy.
Yeah. Brian Murray once spilled a drink on him at the GM's meeting. This is how Brian Murray now shows his loyalty by hiring him on as the head coach and making Dave Cameron his personal dry cleaner.
They should hire back Muckler as a coach. That'd be like bizarro world Senators, right?
That'd be fantastic.
Be like the power struggle all over again.
That'd just be fantastic.
I can
just see Muckler sitting on the bench.
firing up cigars.
During the playoffs, firing up a cigar. The huge in a martini glass, just sitting there elegantly wasted on the bench, barking at Spezza, telling him he's not a man. Oh, that'd be great. Jeez, yeah, that's what I'd like to see from the Senators next year. It'll guarantee us a number one pick next year, right? So all the more reason just to have some fun and have some laughter this year.
Oh, God.
So the World Championships, I actually watched the France-Switzerland game.
Oh, the France-Denmark game, you mean? Or was it Switzerland? Is this the game where DaCosta hit the guy?
No. It wasn't that game. That was Denmark. This was Switzerland. And that game was uglier than Barry Bonds' back. It was disgusting. Maybe the worst hockey I've ever seen at the international level. Kind of makes you wonder why the NHL would ever want to have an affiliation with the IIHF after watching a game like that and seeing the product that was on display. Just terrible. Terrible. Huey actually played a half-decent game. DaCosta was nowhere to be seen, unfortunately. You wouldn't have been able to tell based on that game that he was the only guy besides Huey who's ever even got a cup of coffee in the NHL. Ugly. Definitely not one I'm interested in. So we heard that the Senators were interested in seeing how the first round shook up and what coaches became available immediately after the second round was set. Not too many options. Lindy Ruff got re-signed.
Damn.
Yep.
Like that was ever going to happen.
I know. Unbelievable. Lindy Ruff's going to abandon the franchise that he's been with for how long?
And now that he has an owner who actually will commit money and reinvest in the product. And yeah, everybody's like, oh yeah, Lindy Ruff, he could be the next guy. And
It's
like that disillusioned fan that you're just like, you know who they are. Everybody has one in their group of friends and you just shake your head at them. You're just like, come on, man. Smart note.
Do you even follow hockey? Like, are you aware of what happens around the league beyond the close quarters of Scotiabank Place? He had a snowball's chance in hell of coming to the coaching graveyard in Ottawa with a rebuilding team. Meanwhile, he's got, you know, a perennial playoff contender in Buffalo, seemingly a bright future, committed owner. Why on earth would you leave that situation? He's obviously comfortable living in Buffalo for some...
Yeah, anyway, you know what? That's the first red flag. Anyone who's comfortable living in Buffalo for that long of time, that's not a guy you bring in your town to like fix a situation. That's crazy.
I'm thinking he lives in the basement of HSBC, kind of like Phantom.
He probably lives on the Canadian border. It makes the commute across every day to work.
I don't even know. Border towns are so rough, too, though. Like, have you ever been to Fort Erie?
No, thank God.
Oh, yuck. Or Niagara Falls, USA. That place is rough. That's a rough living right there. That place is what Bytown used to be in the 1800s. Just a bunch of,
horse and carriage, trolley.
Ill will vagabonds and loose women and unkept saloons and, you know, strike breakers and stuff like that. Oh, it's just terrible. Just horrible. You'd swear you were walking through one of those novelty museums in St. Catharines, or not St. Catharines, in Niagara Falls, Canada. Just tacky, but then it's real when you get robbed and you don't, can't make it across the border. Fast horses, loose women.
It's been slow news, aside from the coaching hypotheticals and Jason Spezza's play over in the World Championships. There's not a lot of talk going on these days regarding the Ottawa Senators.
No, bingo's been a pretty big deal.
Yeah, that is a big deal, but I'm not going to pretend that I've been like emotionally invested in what's going on down there. Mind you, I paid significantly more interest once Robin Lehner was inserted as the starting goalie. He's faring quite well. I think he sustained his first loss yesterday in, what, 5 or 6 playoff games?
I actually watched that game yesterday. It was heartbreaking, but Lehner was just up to the challenge. You know, he had a great first, well, yeah, he played amazing, except until that terrible goal in the third. Even then, wasn't really his fault. You know, the kid shows a lot of balls and nets. His positioning was fantastic. He made a couple of clutch saves. He really kept them in the game. They weren't able to muster much offensively. I found through the game a couple of guys, you know, Jim O'Brien, Ryan Keller, these guys had great games. Zach Smith had a great game. Condra, Greening, not so much. You know, Butler, not so much again. Just didn't look like they were able to get anything going, nothing cohesive and sustainable. You know, it's kind of like one of those games where you watch it and they're spending, you know, they have puck possession for a lot of the time, spending a lot of time in Portland's zone. But, you know, they just really couldn't do anything with it. You know, it's like, you know, showing up to the dance, being dressed for it. You know, you get to dance with the girl of your dreams, but at the end of the day, you know, that's where it ends. That's it. You're not going home with her. You're not doing anything. Forget it. It's kind of boring, just kind of lateral. The defense was, it's patchwork, right? I mean, they're missing a lot of bodies back there. It was patchwork. The announcers were hilarious. The stream I was watching was didn't have any cuts for the commercial, so you got to hear the guys talking during intermission. Fantastic. They don't think much of the Binghamton fan base, that's for sure.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there was a big contingency of fans down from Ottawa, I guess, that bus trip there.
Oh, yeah.
Went down, which dictated a lot of their conversation throughout the game. And I was even writing down some quotes to bring with me today, but they got tedious. One of the great ones was, I don't think we'll be seeing this kind of crowd on Monday, I guess, when they play game 4 in Bingo.
So what was the situation? Was it just a raucous crowd? Or?
Yeah, it was a raucous crowd. It was loud. It looked like they had some sort of pseudo-whiteout going on. That was about it. It was fairly loud. There were some neat chants, some cross-connects of go Sens go and go Bingo go. Portland sucks. That was a big one. So, yeah, interesting. I won't tune into another one. I'll just check the box score. Yeah, so it's that time of year. Obviously, as we're discussing Bingo at length in my game recap of game 3, my experiences of watching it streamed online were obviously pretty hard up for material. So I think it'd be good if we talked to someone who actually had something relevant to say, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of parallels drawn between what our guest has to say about what he's written in his book and what the Ottawa Senators are currently going through with their managerial restructuring, on-ice restructuring, etc. So maybe we can learn something. Maybe we can apply some of his life lessons from his research to our trivial little hockey club.
Awesome. Nice segue, Tim. Coming up next, we got Jonah Carey.
Awesome.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back, listeners. Right now, joining us on the line is a man who has written for Fangraphs, Bloomberg Sports, Baseball Prospectus, and ESPN. He also has perhaps the best podcast intro I've ever heard. Jonah Carey, welcome to the Sixth Sense Podcast. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me, Graham.
So, Jonah, recently you've released The Extra 2%, a book that examines how the Tampa Bay Rays have made the ascent up the standings in the difficult AL East. Do you want to talk a little bit about your book to start?
Sure. That's basically the premise, and the idea was, it wasn't just a rise. I mean, they beat the New York Yankees and the Boston Red Sox, which is just a remarkable feat in baseball to be able to knock those teams off, not just once, but twice in 3 years, with a much smaller payroll. I mean, if you look at, you know, it's not easy to come up with an NHL comp because you've got a cap and things tend to be a little bit more balanced, but in, you know, in baseball, you've got the Rays at $40-odd million, knocking off the Red Sox at about $140 million and the Yankees at $220. So how the heck did they do that? And that's really the premise of the book, and it's a far-reaching story. It starts with the city building a stadium on spec to, you know, trying to figure out how to lure a team over there, to the old regime, which was really not very effective, and ultimately to the new regime and what they did to make it work. And, you know, the idea of this extra 2%, it's just looking for 2% advantages in every single thing that you do. And the theory is if you do that well with everything, drafting, developing players, making trades, signing contracts, avoiding injuries, all that stuff, and even off-field stuff like marketing and branding and things of that nature, then you have a chance to potentially knock off a much richer, much more accomplished team, at least a more accomplished team in the past.
All right, Jonah. Now, with the extra 2%, do you think that it will only be proven when the Rays are able to win a World Series? Do you think that winning the AL pennant is a good stepping stone, I guess, for success and measuring the success?
No, I don't buy that at all. I mean, I think, to use an NHL example, if you are very successful and you go deep into the playoffs but you don't win the Stanley Cup, was that a failure? Well, of course not. I mean, the playoffs are short series, and anything could happen in seven games. In hockey, might be a hot pitcher and a hot goalie, and baseball might be a hot pitcher. And I don't view that as a failure at all. The long grind of, in hockey, it'd be 80 games, and in baseball, it'd be 162. If you can get that, and actually, baseball, there's a much smaller pool of playoff teams. So, if anything, it's a better test. And if you can just accomplish that and get to the playoffs, you've done a lot. I mean, the old expression, Billy Beane used to say that his stuff doesn't work, and I'm censoring myself, his stuff doesn't work in the playoffs, and that's kind of accurate. I mean, you're talking about these loopy things that can happen in short series. And no, I don't see it that way. The validation has already happened. To win those two division titles in 3 years is a better accomplishment to me than, let's say, an 83-win team that just, you know, gets lucky in the playoffs and goes on to win the World Series. The World Series is always what's going to count. That's what they're going to raise the trophy and all that good stuff. But if you're talking about objective analysis of what constitutes success, you know, in many ways it would be just having the best record in the league and beating the two best teams in the league.
How do you measure financial success in terms of making it to the ALDS?
Well, the financial success has been difficult for this club. I mean, they play in a market that's not all that receptive to Major League Baseball so far. It's a lousy stadium. They've had trouble, you know, drawing fans. It is getting better, and they had the fifth highest local TV ratings last year, which is amazing, higher than even the Los Angeles Dodgers. So they're doing some good things, but there's still a lot of work to be done, and we can't call this an unmitigated success despite the improvement of the off-field situation, because they really haven't grown revenue as much as they would like to, and part of that is a matter of getting a new stadium, and part of that is that local market has been hit very hard. You're talking about 12% local unemployment, one of the worst local recessions in the entire country. So there are issues like that affecting them, but I mean, you know, it's, at some point you have to say, well, it doesn't matter what the circumstances are, we got to find a way, and the Rays just have to find a way. The financial success, there's been some, but not as much as they would like, and they still have plenty of work to do.
As we talk about the financial success of the Rays, one of the things I found most interesting about your book was the changes to the brand that the head office made when they took over in 2005. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about you know, how much you think these changes have impact the financial stability and viability of the Rays going forward.
Yeah, I mean, the cynic might look at it and say, well, they used to be Devil Rays and now they're Rays, and they changed the logo, and that's about it. But to them, it was a much more serious process than that, almost 2 years in the making. And a lot went into it beyond just changing the uniforms and the name, is really trying to change just the association of the team. And you just think about what they were beforehand. Torrey Hunter once famously said, they asked him, would you rather have a Randy Johnson fastball to the head, or would you rather play for the Tampa Bay Devil Rays? And he said, give me the Randy Johnson fastball to the head, because the suffering will be over very quickly, which I enjoyed. But I mean, ultimately, you have to look at it and say, well, gosh, if that's the reputation of this team, then maybe it's more than new ownership, or maybe it's even more than winning, that you have to find a way to have other things going in your direction. And if it really took, you know, scrubbing it clean and starting over, then that is what they had to do. And I don't think anybody would say that, Torrey Hunter or otherwise, now. Not just because they're a good club, but because they're not a laughingstock anymore. You know, they've done a lot of things to really turn it around. I almost think that it's difficult to extricate the off-field from the on-field. You know, certainly it's helped with their financial situation, with the rebranding and all that, but so has the success. It's kind of gone hand in hand. And I don't know that either of the two would have worked better had it not been for the other.
Jonah, I wanted to ask you about one of the tenets of your book, which was arbitrage, the process of acquiring a player at a low cost and then hoping his value appreciates and then selling him off and recouping more assets than what they initially received for that person. What makes Tampa Bay do it so much better than like another mid to small market team like Pittsburgh? What is Pittsburgh doing
wrong? I would say the Rays are relentless. The whole idea of arbitrage is those small advantages, but nothing is too small. If you literally apply it to the Wall Street sense, it's just a matter of constantly trying over and over. You're going for the edge, you're going for the edge, and you never stop. It's just there is no move that's too small on Wall Street because you have to take advantage of these incremental gains. And every second you're getting, you know, more and more gains, just these little spreads and trades and what have you. And so in baseball, I just think the teams get away from that, that even if you are a small market club, something might seem like too much. It's small potatoes for you. You don't want to make this trade for this A-ball relief pitcher because what are the odds that he amounts to something? Or do you really want to go out and chase that utility infielder for the Astros just because you kind of like him? Is it really worth your while, or do you want to call it a day? And they don't want to call it a day. They're finding ways to go after that stuff. And, you know, with the Rays, those relief pitchers that were scrubs, well, they became J.B. Howell and Grant Balfour, who became key parts of that 2008 ball club that went on to the World Series. And Ben Zobrist was that utility infielder for the Houston Astros who just kind of wasn't doing anything with his career, and they went after this guy, and he turned into this great player. He's the best hitter on the team this year, and he was the best hitter on the team, or at least the second best hitter on the team in 2009. He's really become a frontline kind of player. So they're not willing to give an inch. They just want to go ahead and make all those moves and not view anything as under the radar. You know, even little transactions, if they have to send someone down to the minors, they're thinking about how many options does he have left. If I do this, can I bring him back up to the club? Am I going to lose him? And these are, you know, what you'd call almost scrubby players, 24th, 25th man on the roster. This is like your 7th or 8th defenseman in hockey, and really, really, do you want to try that hard when it's your 8th defenseman? But these guys do, because those little things just seem to add up to a lot. And if you look every offseason, and you look at the Yankees on paper and the Red Sox on paper and the Rays on paper, even the 2 years that the Rays won, there's no way you could have said that the Rays had a better team on paper. It just isn't possible. But through those little moves, and because of their manager, Joe Maddon, who's also very, very good at what he does and can manipulate those pieces and make them work, they're able to be successful. And that is the key to arbitrage, and that's the extra 2%, and that's what the Rays do.
I happened to meet J.P. Howell, actually, when he was pitching for Durham when they came into town in Ottawa. Yeah, he seemed like a really nice guy. But one of the names that you neglected to mention was Sam Fuld. I just wanted to know, how great is that story right now?
Yeah, it's an amazing story. Here's this guy. He's a little guy, first of all, about 5'9", buck 70. He's from the little town that I'm talking to you from, Durham, New Hampshire, which is a quaint little college town with lots of trees, but not much else going on. And economics major from Stanford, diabetic. I mean, just this amazing story. Interned at Stats, Inc., so he's actually, you know, something of a stat head and an intellectual himself. I'm watching him bat as I'm talking to you, as a matter of fact. And he, you know, has just had this amazing success story this year. And if you look at how they acquired this guy, Sam Fuld, a great story in its own right. You've got a case where it's a team that they trade Matt Garza, and that was a big move for the franchise. Matt Garza was a key to that 2008 World Series run, and he was a big acquisition in himself, but they said, okay, the time has come. They get four prospects for Garza, and then they pick up this 29-year-old outfielder. Nobody thinks much of him. He's viewed as kind of the throw-in in that trade, but and I know that it's only a month into the season, but he's been tremendous, and really it's just, again, never giving that up. I imagine the conversation with this trade sort of went, okay, you know, Chicago Cubs, we want these four prospects, and they talk it over for a while, and then almost as you're hanging up the phone, Andrew Friedman and the guys who are negotiating with the Rays would say, oh, yeah, do me a favor, can you throw in your fifth outfielder who played most of last year in the minor leagues? I know you don't really need him, and the Cubs are like, yeah, sure, we don't care, we'll give him up. And he's their leadoff man now. He's been one of their best players, and I don't necessarily think he's going to keep up this pace. I think he'll come back to the pack, and he has a little bit already. But you're just talking about, again, looking for those small advantages. And there's going to be a paperback version to this book that comes out next year. There is a 100% chance that I will be talking about Sam Fuld in the paperback.
I just wanted to ask you about a quote from your book by Andrew Friedman, their general manager. He said, "People ask all the time what our expectations are for the franchise. We don't get caught up in the process. We believe that with the right process, good things will happen." I know you're not an Ottawa Senators fan. You're a Habs fan. And
yeah.
Our owner came out recently, a couple weeks ago. Ottawa started rebuilding towards late February, and then he was all pro for that movement, that youth movement, that rebuild. And then Ottawa had like a small sample size of success going down the stretch, and that kind of swayed him to go out publicly and say, "Hey, you know, maybe this process won't be 3 to 4 years. Maybe this will only be 1 or 2." How would you contrast what Andrew Friedman is preaching and what our owner, Eugene Melnyk, would be saying? And like, as an outsider, how would you evaluate the merits of what either person is saying?
Well, I do think there's value in being patient. There's no doubt about that. And if you look at the Senators' history, and although I am a Habs fan, I mean, I have followed what the Senators have done, this is a team that had a lot of serious talent over the years. Guys like Yashin and Alfredson and, you know, would have great regular seasons and didn't work out well in the playoffs, which is its own kind of tough egg to crack. It's not the only team like that, right? The San Jose Sharks have been doing that for years, and the Washington Capitals and Vancouver Canucks, and maybe it goes better for the Capitals, Canucks, or Sharks this year. I don't know. But it's just a situation where some of these things are tough to control, and so the best that the Senators can do is kind of build that nucleus and be patient, such that when they do make their next playoff run, it's not just a couple of years. They can sustain it and keep it going for a while. And, you know, whether or not they finish as a one seed or make a run at the best regular season record, they'll be well equipped for the playoffs, and they'll be well equipped to make multiple forays into the playoffs. And I think that's what the owner is looking at, and that's what the team is looking at, and it's to their credit. And that's how it's going to go in hockey, by the way. Much like baseball, unlike basketball and football, by the way, you're not drafting guys who are ready at the college level. The number one pick in the NFL draft a couple days ago was Cam Newton. I mean, he was already a beast in college, and I guess quarterbacks aren't the best example, but certainly receivers and running backs, and these guys can contribute right away. Whereas you're drafting 17-year-old kids from Flin Flon, you know? It takes time for those kids to develop. Not everybody's Sidney Crosby, and it's usually, what, 4 or 5 years in the minors or whatever before you're developing. So, yeah, build that nucleus, acquire those draft picks, and get it going. It's hockey and baseball are similar in that way because it can take longer to get those kids through the system as opposed to, you know, they come straight up from college in football and basketball. So it is a good approach to me, and Ottawa is a little bit, I'd say, of a smaller market in hockey, although even that's not direct, right, because Detroit is a big market in hockey, and they're not really a big market in any other sport. But, you know, it's just sort of how it is, and that's the situation that Ottawa's in. And, yeah, I think that if you stay that course and you're intelligent and also aggressive in your decision-making, then eventually good things are going to happen.
Would you say that there's a finer line in hockey because of that hard salary cap?
You know, there can be, but I guess in some ways it's supposed to at least work to the advantage of smaller market clubs, right, that if you're, you know, a team will look at the Blackhawks last year. I mean, they win the cup, and then they kind of have to dismantle their team a little bit, and this was not at all the same club. And so it creates a little bit more of a level playing field because you don't have – the thing is that a salary cap by itself isn't supposed to do that. Like in baseball, people say, well, there should be a salary cap, and then it would make the sport more even. Well, sort of, but the big thing in baseball really is that there's huge amounts of revenue sharing, and hockey doesn't have the same revenue sharing that baseball does. And so if you don't, then you have to come up with another way, and making the cap really hard and relatively small, by the way, is going to be the way that you do it. And I would say that as the Senators come up, and eventually this will be a good club, I know that it seems difficult right now, but it's going to happen, make sure that when you get to that point, you do not sign any cap-killing contracts, because that's what does you in, that eventually you develop these young stars, but then you have to evaluate, who do I want to keep and who do I not want to keep? And you cannot make these mistakes where you sign guys to 10-year contracts or you sign aging veterans because you kind of like their character to multi-year contracts. Be very, very careful. And if you're going to throw a lot of money at a guy, it can't just be because he's the best player on your team. It has to be because he's one of the elite players in the league. That's when you sign a big-time contract. Otherwise, you have to be prepared to let a guy go sometimes or make a trade or figure out other ways, because once you get up against that cap, yeah, it does get tough. And I'm sure that the Senators would love to have a situation like the Blackhawks where you win the cup, but by the same token, it would be nice to be able to have a chance to win, you know, for multiple years in a row and not to have to tear down the team right after it gets good.
Very much like in baseball since the 70s. In hockey, we're slowly starting to see a little bit of, you know, statistical analysis that extends simply beyond goals and assists and goals against average and save percentage. Do you see this kind of statistical analysis having, you know, strong merits and a strong future in hockey, or are there simply too many intangibles? I realize that the whole point of some of these statistics is to prove that there are no intangibles, that everything can be quantitative. So what are your thoughts on that process in hockey?
Oh, I absolutely think that you can evaluate the numbers. I mean, there are numbers in football and basketball, and those are also very fluid sports, where baseball's so easy, right, because it's a hitter versus a pitcher, and whatever happens, that's your outcome, and you can measure it. In hockey, you know, you're looking at, well, what's the value of a goalie if you have a neutral zone trap? I mean, should we readjust our numbers? Or if you are, you know, if you're doing a lot of things well on the penalty kill, but they don't necessarily get reflected on the scoreboard, then how do you adjust for that? Or, you know, if you have this certain kind of player, how do you adjust even if he doesn't put up big numbers, but he kind of does good things on the ice, and maybe that even goes beyond plus minus. So, sure, I mean, there are all kinds of ways, just like basketball and just like football, where you figure out the analytics. And the thing about baseball versus other sports, I would argue also, is part of the reason that we don't know much about hockey, I think, is because it's being done behind closed doors. Baseball, everything was very public. Because you could measure it easier, and because guys like Branch Rickey and then Bill James and people like that, and Baseball Prospectus and now Fangraphs and others have come around kind of beforehand, then you've got a situation where teams are sort of catching up. It was the teams that got going later, and the public kind of determined stathead-ism early on, whereas in hockey, basketball, and football, I think it's the teams that are cutting edge here. We haven't really seen a ton of great public domain hockey stats, but I guarantee you, if you go to doesn't matter which team. Go to the Calgary Flames or the Columbus Blue Jackets or whatever. I guarantee you they've got all kinds of database stuff going on and number crunching and all kinds of interesting ways to do it. So I do think it's happening. I just think as fans we're going to be a little bit shut out from it because there is no vested interest in teams sharing with us all the formulas that they have.
That's a good point because hockey's been for the last, like, I don't know, for as long as I've been around anyways, it's been such a conventional sport where everyone talks about the Sutter brothers who have been in hockey for like 40 years and
yep.
They talk about that wisdom. And I was curious because you're a Habs fan and they've gone through that process of picking a guy like Andrei Markov before Sheldon Surrey when both were up for free agency. And yeah, they've just went with Carey Price and instead of going with the popular decision in Halak. And I think you're right in saying that a lot of the decisions that are going on in hockey these days are behind closed doors. And I think many people these days are even looking at the Nashville Predators and their success and saying, what is that team doing right?
Yeah, there's no question. The Price-Halak move I particularly liked a lot, by the way. Halak was not a terrific goalie, and then he has that one playoffs. And I think it's just so reactionary in Montreal. You had Le Journal de Montréal, one of the local papers, comes out with an editorial cartoon, and it portrays Halak as Jesus at the Last Supper wearing a Habs jersey. I mean, there's just a certain amount of mania, and I think that whatever you do, if it's unorthodox, you're going to get more flack in Montreal than you will in other places, and full credit to them for doing that. So there's no question about it, and that was a gutsy move, I would say, and it has worked out pretty well so far, although they're not in the playoffs anymore. But yeah, you know, you are looking at things from behind closed doors. I will say Gabriel Desjardins does very good work. He has a blog called Behind the Net. It's recommended. Puck Prospectus, the Hockey Prospectus guys, they do good work too. But yeah, there aren't a ton of great sites out of there. And so you just got to kind of play along with your team. You know, if your team does make an unorthodox move, if you're a Nashville fan or a Habs fan or whatever fan, try and go deeper level. Don't just say, well, this guy had 30 goals and the other guy had 28. Why are we taking the 28 guy? Try to figure out why it might be, because I think that, you know, you look at what constitutes analysis, it's not necessarily really complicated numbers or formulas. A lot of it is just thinking. It's just, why would it be? How could it be that this happened? And I think that if you do that, then you become not just a more enlightened fan or even a geekier fan or whatever. I think it becomes more fun. I mean, if I was as someone who's kind of followed the Rays and picked it up, I find it very interesting to kind of play along with the manager, the general manager, and I think that you'd be that way if you were a Senators fan, too. You'd say, well, yeah, this is interesting. You know, why did they do this? Why are they double-shifting this guy who doesn't seem to be that kind of good a player? Why did they make that trade or that draft pick? I think that becomes a lot of fun, and it's worth digging in a little bit deeper.
Yeah, I've tried that with Ottawa, Jonah, and most of the times I come back to, oh, yeah, that's a PR move.
Well, and that might be the case, too, and that's unfortunate, and that might mean that you have the wrong management and the wrong approach, because it's not like every team is smart, but you hope that as they go along, they'll start to figure some things out, and then it will go beyond that. It's weird about hockey, right? Because you get, gosh, I mean, I can remember growing up a Habs fan, and there was just such a premium placed on, what, French-Canadian players, right? And, of course, if you had Guy Lafleur, no problem, but if you had Gaston Gingras, that was a big problem. You know, some French-Canadian players are better than others, and you hope it's not the case that they're picking up someone because he's from Canada or whatever the hell. You know, you want him to – there's got to be a reason that you're picking up a player beyond – the obvious local ties or something that just seems to be good PR, sure, no question.
Well, Louis LeBlanc is certainly looking okay for the Habs right now. He's certainly jumped up a lot of the prospect rankings from what I've seen.
Yep.
So that's a good one. But, you know, being a Sens fan and recently seeing some very popular local players like Mike Fisher sent packing to Nashville onto greener pastures, that move was very heavily criticized in Ottawa just because of his wife and his popularity in the community. And much like with Halak, you know, I remember my girlfriend being obsessed with those Halak stop signs that were put up all over Montreal.
Nice.
And it's nice to see management not cave to, you know, the social pressures of the fan base. And your fan base, I just recently saw on GQ, was rated the 11th worst fan base in terms of fan action during games and I think most notably after games in Montreal. You know, everywhere Montreal plays, they seem to just be magnets of hate, and even in Ottawa, I mean, and the presence of Habs fans at the Senators games isn't even as strong as it is with other teams like Toronto, but there's still such, you know, a loathe for the fan base and for the team. Why do you think this is, as being a member of this fan base?
I think there's a few things going on. Number one, I the elephant in the room is the cultural thing. Is you're talking about a lot of fans just come from a different culture. They're French-Canadian, and that's fine with some people, and it's not fine with other people. But, you know, having established that, yeah, sure, I think it's the case that there are other things going on with Habs fans. It's a very strange thing for me because I grew up a fan of the Habs and the Montreal Expos, probably a bigger, definitely a bigger Expos fan than a Habs fan, but followed both clubs. I mean, the Expos,
gosh, we know what happened to them. They moved away, and they were a laughingstock and all this, and they needed me, right? I mean, they were just a fan base in disarray. They needed any fans that they could pick up, and myself and my idiot friends constituted 50% of their season ticket holders, it seemed like. Whereas if you're talking about the Habs, it's a little bit of the Yankees of hockey. And mind you, they haven't won many cups in the last few years, and I think you're kind of going on legacy here more than recent success. But still, just to have that, yeah, they're blue bloods, and they're an original six club, and they've won all these cups and stuff, and there's an arrogance that goes with that. And I have friends who are Yankees fans, and some are arrogant and some are not. And it's just sort of how it is. And I think that there's, you know, that combination of factors that goes into it, and I can understand that. And two, I would just say that they have certain rituals, right? I mean, the soccer chat, the ole, 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 which is very ripped off from soccer, is very unusual and open to ridicule, I guess, and other teams aren't doing that. And there's just certain things that are there with Habs fans that you don't see with other fans. And I don't know. I mean, I tend to look at the positive and everything, and I'm an optimistic guy, and I just say, this is a fan base that really, really cares, that they live and die with that team, and that even though they consider themselves royalty, I mean, it matters. It matters a lot. And however it manifests itself, as long as you're not beating the crap out of someone after a game, I don't really care. Be as obnoxious as you want. It's fine with me if you're a Yankees fan or a Habs fan or any other fan. Actually, the fans that I find the most amusing are the Toronto Maple Leafs fans, because they have this kind of complex, too, where it's just, oh, the Leafs this and the Leafs that, and yeah, but they haven't done anything in 45 years or whatever. At least the Habs have had some modicum of success. Leafs fans seem to be both tortured and somewhat arrogant for some strange reason, even though they're a bad, bad team. So there is that. And by the way, any chance I get to dump on Leafs fans in any podcast, I'm happy to do.
Oh, yeah, you have to take that opportunity.
Of course.
So you went to a first-round game between Boston and Montreal.
I did.
What are your thoughts from the first round, even though your team was beat?
I mean, that game in particular was a lot of fun, and the Habs ended up winning, and that series was great. I mean, I have no complaints about the Bruins, and everything was on the up and up, and they won fair and square, and Tim Thomas was great, and they got some clutch goals from guys like Horton, and you know, some not necessarily elite snipers, and it just worked out well for them, and good for them, and that's great. And I thought there was a lot of great action. But gosh, at the end of the Vancouver-Chicago series, the Vancouver nearly blew that series lead. Would have just been devastating, and to get that catharsis with the overtime goal is tremendous. Not from one of the Sedin brothers, no less. So that was amazing. Lots of good stuff happened, and I think the playoffs are going to be interesting going forward, too. I think that especially Caps and Canucks, I mean, they're the one seed, so they're going to get attention, but they've just had this reputation of being chokers in the playoffs. And although I did pick a bunch of first-round upsets, for the finals, I did have Caps and Canucks. I just looked at those teams, and maybe it's not original to take two number one seeds, but it looked like it was their year. It just looked like these were two teams that were clearly superior to the rest. So I think that's going to be interesting. You know, can the Flyers overcome having a huge goalie disadvantage against the Bruins? Didn't work so well in game one. Nashville's tied up that Vancouver series. How's that going to go? Is Detroit going to get back to the glory years? Are we just sleeping on this team? You know, this is a good team, but is this possibly a great team, and are they destined to win another cup? I mean, there's a lot of stuff that's in play so far, and it's really good. I've been paying closer attention. Well, that's not true. I was going to say closer attention this year than many other years, but of course the Habs with that amazing run last year, you know, where they were the low seed and go deep into the playoffs was great. So probably the last two or three years I've just found the playoffs to be really entertaining, and moving south of the border to the States and having kids and all this, you lose track of some things, and I have a hard time following NHL regular season, at least as closely as I used to, but I've been getting up for the playoffs. It's been really, really exciting, and even with my team eliminated, I'm still enjoying the games.
Absolutely. I think this has been one of the best first rounds I've seen in a long time. I know I'm not the first to say that. Many others have echoed it, but it's just been great. So many amazing storylines. The journalists must just be licking their chops after every single game. There's just so many great stories to be told, and it's great reading them and watching the games for that matter. Now, Jonah, at the end of the interviews, we'd like to do a little quick answer with the guest. Would you be willing to do that?
Sure, go ahead.
Okay, great. First one I got for you. But where's the best smoked meat in Montreal?
Schwartz's next.
Favorite Habs memory?
Favorite Habs memory? That's a good one. You know, the Cup in 93 was obviously tremendous, and that's the age, it's the most recent Cup, which is sad. But it's the age that I can best appreciate it. By then I would have been, 18, and people were rioting. And that's another thing that Habs fans get derided for, that win or lose, they seem to riot a lot. And I can remember we watched a game on TV, and being young idiots, of course, we didn't want to stay at home in the suburbs. We drove right to the middle of the riots, and we didn't do anything. I wasn't flipping any cars, but I was standing on cars, and I was acting like a jackass and trying to get on camera and doing all that stuff. And that was a fun time. That was a good night, I would have to say, that night that they won the cup. I really enjoyed that.
Classic. Um, Yeah. What's the best concert you've ever been to and the most anticipated concert of the summer?
You know, that's a good one. Some of my favorite concerts are little club concerts. I mean, I saw, and it's not even necessarily the quality of the artist necessarily. I saw Matis Yahu, who's the Hasidic Jew reggae rapper guy. I saw him at the Shoebox in Seattle, which is a really cool old venue. And he was not really well known at that time. He's not my favorite artist by any means. And I listened to that one album, and that was about it. And it's not like he's my favorite necessarily. But there was just an amazing energy in this guy. And what's with this guy? And he's wearing this religious garb. And he was stage diving and beatboxing. And it was just this really cool show. And I saw MGMT before they became popular in Boston at the Paradise. That was also kind of a similar show. It was this low-key vibe, and then these guys come on, and I was friends with their friends from college, so I actually talked to the guys from the band during the opening set. They were just standing in the audience, and I was chatting with them, and they just seemed like cool guys, and then they killed it. I'm like, oh my God, these guys could be huge. And so I don't know, I just enjoy that small vibe whenever you can get that kind of opportunity. But probably my favorite random memory of a concert was kind of a whole day. It was Canada Day. This is in the 90s. This would have been like, it had to be 97 or 98, actually, because Roger Clemens was with the Jays. And the Expos were playing the Jays, and Roger Clemens was pitching, and he was at the height of his powers. And Jeff Juden pitched for the Expos, and I think had 14 strikeouts and actually out-dueled Clemens, which was amazing. And my buddy, another Expos fan, and I, we had a great time there. And then there was a Rush concert going on down the street at, I guess it's the Molson Amphitheater. And we ran out of the baseball game at Rogers Center. I basically did a dead sprint all the way down to the amphitheater, which is probably, I don't know, mile and a half. Got there. There was only maybe 45 minutes left in the show. We see a scalper. Scalper goes, $75 a piece for tickets. We go, no, dude, we'll give you 15 for the pair. He goes, okay, fine. 15 for the pair. We go in. And it was the beginning of a Neil Peart drum solo for the Trees. And that was really amazing, too. So that just that kind of experience, that just random, oh, we managed to make it to the concert right after the baseball game was pretty cool. And what was the other question about the concert, sorry?
Most anticipated for the summer?
Yeah.
Most anticipated for the summer. I got small kids. I haven't been to a concert in a little while. I'm trying to think what I would probably want to go see. I don't have any anticipated for the summer is the answer to your question. I'll start looking at the schedule, and I'll see if I can sneak away with a couple of buddies. I have 18-month-old twins, so it does make it a little bit challenging. I'm not as much of a music follower as I used to be. But I'll tell you, Radiohead tours, and we will be there in 2 seconds. We've seen them about 7 or 8 times, and we'll see them again anytime.
It was hilarious that you brought up Jeff Juden. My favorite memory of that guy was that infamous brawl in Montreal where he was running the gauntlet, and I think he took on about 5 guys.
He was a big dude.
Oh, yeah.
He wasn't all that good a pitcher. Despite being all that big, he didn't throw terribly hard. That 14 strikeout game was, I mean, it was probably the best game, not only of his Expos career, maybe of his career, period, and we just happened to be there. It was an amazing experience.
All right, predictably, where did the Tampa Bay Rays finish in the standings this year?
I think they're going to finish third, the Red Sox winning the division, the Yankees winning the wild card. They've surprised me. I mean, starting 0-6 and coming back the way they have, they're winning today. They might go to 16-12, so that would make them, what, 16-6 since that start. They're the first team in Major League history to finish April with a winning record after going 0-6. That's pretty cool, especially without Evan Longoria and Manny Ramirez. It's a great comeback, but I still think they're a batter or two short, and I love their pitching staff and I love their defense, but I don't know if they have the hitting to overcome the Yankees. I definitely don't think they do to overcome the Red Sox. Red Sox have been not great so far, but I still think they're the club to beat in that division. I think it could be close with the Yankees and the Rays. If the Rays make a trade or two, that could change things, but on a talent level, looking at it now, I have them finishing third.
What do you think about the prospect of adding another wild card?
I don't feel strongly about it either way. I don't love it. I mean, I am a bit of a traditionalist, and I think that anything that you do that potentially erodes the accomplishments of a regular season team, we just talked about that earlier. You asked me, well, if they don't get to the World Series, if they don't win the World Series, have they accomplished much? I just come back to it's 162 games, and if you win 100 or 98 or whatever, especially in a tough division, that should count for a lot. And every bit that you erode it, whether it's 5-game series at the beginning of the playoffs or adding extra teams, it takes away from it a little bit. There's a lot to be said for especially hockey, because I think hockey teams are closer maybe than in other sports. And so, you know, an 8 seed has a chance, and if it's a hot goalie, whatever. But in baseball, I don't know. I don't want to see the 12th best team in baseball, or the 14th or the 16th, or maybe not even the 10th in the playoffs. I do like the smaller playoffs, and I think it differentiates it a little bit. But having said that, you know, if you're a fan of, I don't know, Toronto Blue Jays, let's say, it's good news. You know, you give yourself a chance to make the playoffs a little bit more. It could potentially boost revenue a little bit for baseball, which obviously is the thing that they care about. So even though my heart says, well, I'm not crazy about this, yeah, my mind says it's not the end of the world. It's really not that bad.
Right. Word association with Jeff Loria.
carpetbagger.
Awesome. All right, Jonah, thank you very much for coming on our podcast today. We appreciate it. Listeners, if you haven't bought it already, go ahead and pick up the extra 2%. It's a fantastic read, and you'll really enjoy it. But Jonah, thanks again for coming on, and hopefully you'll come back on in the future.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Hey,
all right, take care. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Tuesday, taking pictures in the streets. We were wearing kitten masks. We were wearing kitten masks. Got no shame cause we're alone. We're teenagers.
So I thoroughly enjoyed that interview.
Yeah, that was great. And I love the fact that Joe and I believe was the second person on this podcast this year to have an American Civil War reference during the Quick Hits, which is great.
Who was the first?
Dr. John Soares from Notre Dame.
Right, yeah.
Remember when he was here?
Yep.
Yeah, fantastic. So always end on a high note, just like in Vegas, right?
I could sit down and talk baseball and hockey for, you know, it's just the time flies. He was on for, what, like close to half an hour?
Yeah.
And the time just flew by. But I think reading his book and listening to what Jonah had to say, there are a lot of parallels. And like there are lots of moments of introspect when I was reading his book where I say, shit, like, why doesn't Ottawa do this? Why don't the Senators do this? Why don't they practice these policies? And I don't know if it's whether we're a Canadian franchise and they kind of feel like our fans will show up regardless and we should treat them. You can get away with anything. And talking to some fans, everybody has their own horror story at one point, right? But there are tons of moments in his book where you just sit down and you're thinking to yourself, shit, why aren't the Senators this proactive in their approach to not only how do they handle their fans, but their hockey club?
Oh, absolutely, and I hate to use this as a terrible analogy, but, I mean, it's like cattle, right? They treat the fan base like cattle. It's just a matter of herding them into the building every day. More or less, within a couple hundred fans, you're going to get the same kind of turnout daily. And instead of bringing in new cattle from other pastures and being kind to your cattle, they're just same things over and over again, same incentives, same game day entertainment. Like, you know, one of the things, I know we talked about this in the interview, but the branding and, you know, the fan experience. When was the last time you walked into Scotiabank Place and had even if you just bought a single game ticket and had someone shake your hand and say, you know, thanks for coming out today. Really appreciate your support. 2 seconds, just a nice greeter beyond the guy who rips your tickets, right? It'd be nice. I want to feel like someone.
But if we're going to go on this branding tangent, I'm always reminded of the interview that we had with Cyril Leader, and it was a great interview, but one of the things I was kind of surprised at was the reference to the new Heritage jersey that's coming out next season as just window dressing. I realized at the time he was kind of referring to like how they have to restructure everything that's within their organization, and that's like a subsidiary thing that they're not really worried about, but that's part of your brand. Anything related to that hockey team is part of the whole brand package, and you have to be proud, and you have to be just, it has to be iconic, right? Or am I wrong to say that?
Oh, no, I absolutely agree. And, you know, to Cyril's credit, you know, I will say that he was on here to talk about something and really stuck to that message and hammered it home. And it's something at that point in time the Sens fans needed to hear. I think maybe he might re-choose those words of calling, you know, the branding and new sweaters as window dressing. As, you know, Jonah Carey points out, dropping the term devil from Devil Rays did wonders for their brand, right? It was great. So many things, like the food in the stadiums, was wild to me. How does that work? How does allowing fans to bring in their own food actually drive up concession sales? Is that just unique to America? Like, do they not understand?
Maybe if they know because they're Americans, they'll keep eating, regardless of whether or not they bring in their own.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm guessing somewhere they have a statistician who is saying, you know, a bigger, well-fed fan's just going to want more. Maybe they're not bringing in their drinks. They're too heavy. Brilliant, though. Just brilliant. Really nice to see people thinking outside of the box, just like we saw when Jeff Hunt came to Ottawa and started with the 67s. He looked like a genius, right? And if some of these moves that Tampa Bay implemented ever came to Ottawa, we wouldn't know what to do with ourselves because of the brilliance of them.
Let me read you this quote from what Jonah Carey's book. I just want to get your opinion on it, and I want you to relate it to the Senators, as you see, as an organization. This quote comes from Vince Gennaro. We're transitioning away from the GM as a superhero figure. And today, you have to have an infrastructure in place if you want to successfully run an organization.
First thing comes to mind is Roy McGregor's piece on the plan, quote, yeah, definitely. Like, it seems like they want to bring structure and stability. It makes perfect sense, right? I mean, what's the definition of insanity? Doing a million things the same way and expecting different results. If you're going to draft the same way, treat local players, you know, who are, you know, considered good in the community the same way over and over again, you're going to experience similar results. I mean, granted, there's a lot of unique personalities at play, and you can't really account for everything turning out the exact same way over and over again because hockey players and management and coaches are unique, as are the X factors being the other teams. But I think that's really important to have a process, at least have a plan. Everyone knows year after year what you're going to get from, you know, the Oakland Athletics, what you're going to get from the Detroit Red Wings. These are very stable, consistent franchises that implement the same method of thinking into you know, their on-field or on-ice product year after year. And I think that's really important to do, whether or not you have success with it. Oakland obviously hasn't won a World Series since Billy Beane has been at the helm. And
To be honest, I've never really been close.
No, they haven't.
They've gotten to the dance, but they haven't.
Yeah.
They're like that kid sitting on the corner watching everybody else have fun with the girl.
It's always been their bats, too. They've always had those amazing staffs.
Yeah, no, that's true. Like, Tim Hudson, Mark Mulder.
Even nowadays with Cahill, Anderson, I mean, those are good pitchers. I think those are dirty, dirty pitchers. And I think at that point, you have to have something in place. As Roy McGregor alluded to, maybe they are thinking of restructuring the Senators to work more like Hockey Canada. Maybe Eugene Melnyk is really enamored with that model, thinks it can work. And if they think that that's going to be the model that works well for Ottawa, then so be it. Roll with it, right? You?
It's interesting because it is a vague quote, right, that I read to you. And I'm just wondering, like, I know, like, Tampa Bay is in the book. Tampa Bay's model that they have right now isn't really hierarchical. So I'm not sure how much talking in retrospect, I should have asked Jonah a little bit about how much feet get stepped on with the Rays in terms of decision making. Is it, you know, like, who has the final say of authority? How much do they rely on their scouts? Because looking at Ottawa's situation, we, on the surface, it looks like we have a meddlesome owner who's, you know, he's in the hockey ops decision-making. And whether or not it's a white lie or it's lip service paid by Eugene Melnyk when he was referencing the Mike Fisher trade, I'm a bit nervous.
How about during the Tampa Bay draft when the owners...
Oh, that's a fantastic read, yeah.
When the owners are off playing RBI baseball in a different room, just leave the draft to the scouts.
Yeah, right? Which is uncanny. You're thinking as from an outsider's perspective, you wouldn't think that the GM of a baseball team would be off in his office playing a Nintendo Entertainment System in like a baseball game that's like 20 years old while the rest of his scouts are conducting the draft. I think that's incredible.
Yeah, and to be fair, like if I was the owner of an NHL team, you're damn right, I'd be right in the thick of things, listening in at least, maybe not trying to sway professional talent evaluators one way or the other, but I'd still be curious at least, right?
That's just an indication of how confident he is with what they have in terms of their scouting personnel. To me, it's mind-blowing.
Oh, it's brilliant, and it's working for them.
Mind you, looking back at the Senators situation, I know on last week's show you referenced the Erik Karlsson drafting when Brian Murray wanted to, you know, go after his big Canadian guy.
I want to know who that was.
Yeah, that'd be interesting in retrospect to look back at the draft. I'm sure if we looked at like who was taken when, you could probably deduce who it was. But yeah, like that's a classic example where the scouts kind of
Probably Zach Smith.
But it's weird. You wonder, is Brian Murray a yes man? The scouts have kind of that swaying power over him then. And if Eugene Melnyk is swaying Brian Murray to like trade Mike Fisher to Nashville just to look out for Mike, then come on, Brian, have some pull.
It's interesting. Like there's that one really great YouTube clip of Pierre Dorion when he's in Sweden watching
Rundblad.
Yeah.
He's watching Rundblad and Larson.
Adam Larson. At Scaletta, and the way that he speaks about David Rundblad when he's talking to the reporter who maybe asks him, you know, is he a problem? Is his defensive play an issue? Like the passion and the certainty in which he speaks about this player, they are really confident and it's seemingly willing to stand behind their player and their decision. Even when, we had him on the show last year, definitely the sense I got is that they back their players 100%. And I don't know if that was Pierre Dorion's voice when they traded for Rundblad or if that was Forsberg's voice or who it was. But it doesn't matter because you hear them now and they're sold on them.
I think if we look back at that Dorion interview when he came on, he was very, at least the perception that I had from it was that it was a very confident maybe collective of scouts. Like they kind of knew they had a game plan. I don't know. It was just like this changing confidence, this unbridled confidence, maybe, where you could tell this was a guy who took his job seriously. And
yeah, and when he walked us through the plan, when they compile their list, blah blah blah, yeah, and try and compress it, arduous, serious business, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's good to know. That's why I think that there's no point in even trying to guess what the Senators are going to do this year in the draft, because they're just so unpredictable. It could be like, who knows, right? Who knows? But regardless of what they do, they'll probably do it right. And that's one thing we've had going for us.
Yeah. As long as the organizations learn from their previous mistakes and the slate's clean and they know what they're doing going forward, I don't necessarily have a problem with it.
And if the process, you know, that the Senators are implementing obviously has to have a lot of room for the scouts and for the talent evaluators on the team, then we've already got one foot in the door.
I like it.
That's all you can really say.
So it's funny because last week we were talking about the show this week, and we were mentioning that we were hoping to bring in like two well-connected hockey people who could help us disclose who Ottawa might possibly be taking at six. But obviously it didn't really work out the way we wanted it to. But we're hoping that both of the people who we're referring to will be on our show next week. So
it's a busy time of the year for these guys too, right?
No, that's true too.
The fact that we even got the time of day from either of them is unreal.
It only bodes well, right?
Yeah, of course.
So we're hoping to have them on next week. So cross our fingers on that. But Jonah Carey, thank you so much for coming on our show this afternoon. We had a blast talking with you. And I can't encourage our listeners and readers to pick up his book enough.
Yep.
The Extra 2%, get it on Amazon, order it on Chapters, do whatever you have to do. Get it. It's a good read.
It may be a baseball book. I think that we did a good job in the interview of discussing it, but it's so applicable to every other sport.
No, out absolutely.
There. And I think that, you know, the nature of it, if you like baseball, great. If you like finance, even better. I'm sure there's a lot of money hungry people out there. People seem to love the salary cap and all that stuff. So, I mean, why not? Perfect book for everyone.
Definitely. You want to get out of here?
Yep, let's go.
Awesome. Thanks, listeners, for listening to the show this week.
Thank you, Jonah Carey.
Hopefully, we'll talk to you soon. We'll be right back.